Some of you are going to be Madrichim in Akiva next year, and others of you are going to be Madrichim in life for your families and your children, Bezrat Hashem, all of you, as you continue. And Chazal tell us, Utshua Berov Yoetz. The more people think together, the more people try to get advice, the more there's a chance of attaining a salvation, of getting where we want to get to. So an intelligent person plans out his path before he goes into it. Of course, you'll always learn things on the job, but as much as we can think in advance, so we should. And so, thank you, Ellie, for erasing the blackboard. Let's make a list. Who wants to write on the blackboard? I could do it, but you guys probably have more handwriting than me. Go ahead. Okay, you have colors here. You could be colorful. Let's make a list of what are the things that we think, if we have, let's say we're going to have a whole year, what ages are you guys going to be with? Do you know? Okay, so let's make a list of what are our goals. What do we want to give these kids at the end of the year? I am listening. You're from Australia. You are? New Zealand. Okay, so you might have different goals. David, you want to begin? Okay, so let's write that down. Let's give each person's name so we could always go back to who said what. So David is telling us understanding of Judaism, tefillah, and you're saying, where are you from?
New Zealand.
You guys don't have Jewish education, so I just want to tell you, but my mother brought me up every night. My bedtime story was Tanakh. By the time I reached elementary school, I knew all of Tanakh. Because at night, my mother would read me Tanakh as a bedtime story. She would tell me the stories, not verbatim, but tell me the stories. And my mother always says that her whole knowledge of Judaism came from Bnei Akiva. That she grew up, where she grew up, my grandparents worked with Mizrahi. They were traveling all over. And they had no Jewish education. They were in Mexico, Argentina. They were all over the world. They were traveling, helping Jews. And they had a little girl who had no Jewish education. And all of her Jewish education came from Bnei Akiva. So when you're saying that we have to fill in the gap of Jewish education in these places, I don't take that lightly. I hear you 100%. So what were the words we wrote? Understanding of Judaism. And now, sorry David, we're going to continue with you until we continue to the next guy. Let's define for ourselves, when we say understanding of Judaism, what is it that we want to give them? Meaning for some people, understanding of Judaism is you wear a Magen David necklace and you buy one mezuzah on your house, and on Yom Kippur you drive up the shul. I assume that's not what we're talking about. So what are we talking about? Now you understand why I'm asking, because the more we refine what we want to do, the better we will be at it and the more we could prepare for it. You mind writing it down?
Yeah.
Shabbos, davening.
And then they, although they may not congratulate, they may not like straight away, they may not straight away want to like go in that direction. At least gives them understanding of this, so that option's always open to them. When they sitting at home in a family that doesn't really like give them up, they don't really care that much. Then they're not going to ever. Then why would they ever?
Okay, so if I could maybe add, I think that maybe we should think of the Jewish calendar, meaning not only Shabbat, but when we're talking about holidays, so part of that would be the calendar. So when we're when we're going to approach the people, when we're approaching the year, part of what we have to think in advance is, okay, what do we want to target now? We want to target, let's say the year is going to begin, when do you guys start? In a month? In 2 months? In 2 months. Okay, so you're starting now, we are in Cheshvan, Tammuz, Cheshvan, Kislev, Tevet. So you're starting in Tevet, there are no holidays then. So then you would focus on Shabbat, and when we finish going around, when we decide what we're going to focus on, so then we have to think about what are we going to do, what angles should we take? Meaning, when I brought Rabbi Ginsburg yesterday, my goal was, I heard that's not what happened, my goal was that he spend an hour and a half telling you guys stories. That you guys just get a tremendous amount of stories so that you have information you could take with you about Shabbat. When we spoke initially, that was the plan. I don't know what switched there. The plan was you guys get an hour and a half just stories on Shabbat. So you have material when you're going back to Bnei Akiva to give stories. I got feedback this morning that that's not what happened yesterday. And I don't know, I haven't spoken to him yet. I don't know where the miscommunication lay. Okay, thank you. So I think we're going to discuss technique soon. But first, if you're coming in Tevet, so you have the month of Tevet, you have the month of Shvat, where you could touch on Tu B'Shvat in the land of Israel, which you didn't mention, and I think
well,
that might be a point. No shear.
Oh, how do you put across a how do you like get kids to come but put it in the fun?
Oh, so we're going to get to that. We'll get to that.
I think God also means for kids at least about Judaism, it means having more you need to put more emphasis on the history side of it rather than the religious side of it. For kids.
Jewish history.
Let's say I'm not sure what you mean. I'm listening.
Looking over the Torah and what is happened in our past rather than, saying to teach about me, this, that, and this, don't do this, don't do that.
Ah, for sure.
These two that go before then go, this is why we teach about. I think that's
the
tradition. So I think we have to discern. When you're dealing with a 9-year-old, I don't think you have to spend so much time explaining. You should explain in passing. But I don't think you should spend so much time explaining. I noticed there was a Shabbat where a guy came here, and there was a group here with us. And when the guy came to make Kiddush, so he just said one sentence. We're doing Kiddush, which is a biblical commandment that God says we commemorate Shabbat. You guys know that guy. We were all there when that guy was there, and he said it. God told us on the seventh day we rest just as God rested after 6 days of work, and just as the Jews are... were able to rest after leaving Egypt, so the Kiddush is a commemoration of these 2 points. Pretty short sentence, right? Took all of 20 seconds. How old were the guys standing around? 18, 19-year-olds? I don't think he had quiet for the completion of the sentence. You guys know who I'm talking about, yeah? Okay, so 19-year-olds aren't going to listen. I'm just saying, I'm not sure 9-year-olds are going to listen either if we preach, if we say it like, even in a way that's in passing.
No, I'm not talking about preaching, I'm saying... that before you say, if we're doing Shabbat, you need to say, you need to explain why we're doing Shabbat.
I'm saying, how many people knew here, this past Shabbat, when we were all together, how many people knew the concept of Kiddush that corresponds to these 2 things, and that's what we're doing? Most people tell you Shabbat, well, God rested on the seventh day, and they'll forget to tell you about the Jews leaving Egypt.
No, that's what I'm talking about.
So I understand, but I'm saying, did guys know that before Kiddush this week?
No.
I doubt it. And yet guys didn't want to listen. And these are mature guys who are going to be madrichim in Bnei Akiva.
That's exactly why I'm saying that. Those are the sort of things that shouldn't be taught.
Saying, but that's also history. That's the reasoning behind it. I think that we want to engage them in song. We want to engage them in the fun aspects of Shabbat. And what we do. Shabbat, we have 2 challahs. Let them taste. What delicious challahs are. I think we engage them in the positive. Lighting candles. How many girls light candles? So if their mother does it at home, good. But if not, then you bring them to a Jewish home. One of the things I always try to do is get people connected to homes. Meaning, what I want us to think about is what can we do in Bnei Akiva, and how can we help them beyond Bnei Akiva. Meaning, in Bnei Akiva, I agree with you that we can't focus on laws, but I don't think we could go to history either. I think we have to focus more on hands-on. Let them experience it. And through the experiences, if they bring it up, they ask, we could get to it. But even just explaining history, I don't think we could get to. Not in our day and age.
So you shouldn't, so we don't think you can pay that. You shouldn't otherwise.
Oh, I'm not saying not to. I'm just saying that's not where I'm looking for my successes.
Then how they experience it, I don't know what they're
doing. Oh, so let me tell you how they experience it. I have a Seder in my house every year for tens of people. Every year. What? No, strangers. not my family. Students from Machon Meir, people who are Gerim, people who are do tshuva and don't have family, to go to people I've never seen a Seder. And then, I have a small family. You saw my kids. I mean, we're a total of five. My wife, me, and three kids. We have a lot of other people. And whoever comes to the Seder is invited, firstly, to help clean. No one comes. Okay. Then, I say, whoever wants to come to help clean. I say, want to experience Pesach? Come clean. You don't want to come clean? So come and see how we do Bdikas Chametz. Sometimes we get a few people who come, sometimes not. But then I say, if you want to come to the Seder, there's one thing which you have to do, and that is come the eve of Pesach, after we burn the Chametz, to help us prepare. That you have to do. You want to come? You have to help us. You're allowed to come if you don't. But I expect of each participant in the Seder to come help us. And I let them grind the maror, so then I have a room full of grown men crying. We have a small apartment. You guys haven't been there. Our whole apartment is about the size of this room. So we're sitting in the dining room, which is about this big, like from that doorway till the wall. It's a very small room. We're all standing there grinding horseradish. So the room is so filled with fresh horseradish, people are standing there literally tearing. I have pictures, every year I take pictures of grown men standing there crying, grinding horseradish, and everyone likes it. Now, after we grind horseradish, I tell them, here's how you make charoses. You make it. I don't make the charoses. Me and my wife, we don't make charoses. The guests make the charoses. As much as we can, when I go to choose the matzahs, 3 months in advance before Pesach, I go to the matzah factory and I choose each matzah. I bring along 30 or 40 people with me, some which will be my guests, some won't. And I let them experience it. I'm not telling them, look, this is matzah. I'm telling them, I need matzah. I'm Pesach, we're going to eat matzah. By the time they come to the Seder, they've already experienced many aspects of it. After that, so as we're grinding, I could tell them about, hey, this is, you see that it looks like mortar? We add a little bit of wine. Everything in passing, but not as a class. Again, I agree with you.
No, I wouldn't. Okay, I don't mean to say that kids should sit down and learn. They can't do that. But what I was trying to say is that before you start explaining halakha and everything, practical or not, you need to explain reason, history too.
So there I think we have to discern between ages. My goal would be from 9 to 13 to get them accustomed to it. Whatever I can explain to them they want to hear, fine. But if he doesn't want to hear about why you stand with your feet together in Shmona Esrei, and quite honestly, to me and you, I don't understand why I stand with my feet together in Shmona Esrei. I can tell you what it says in the Gemara, I can tell you what it says in the Halacha, but I don't understand it. I can tell you, there's a concept.
That's high level though. Talking about basics.
So, it's pretty basic to stand Shmona Esrei with your feet together.
Well, everyone does. I don't know why.
So I can tell you why. One of the concepts is that when I stand before God, I recognize that I'm limited. I can't go where I want, so I stand with my feet together. That I understand. The source for it is because the angels, when they stand in heaven, their feet are straight, etc. They look like a 1 foot. That I don't understand. I don't know what that means. But the angels don't need feet, right? They also don't need wings. So then, what are we talking about? So I don't know what I'm talking about. And I think it's important to tell kids. I don't know. Yes, I don't know. I studied it, I learned it, I analyzed it, and I don't understand it. I might one day, and I might not. And I could live with the question. Okay, so we're basically in agreement. We both agree that what we can, we will tell the kids. And our goal is to let them experience. What else? David?
I just wanted to say, my main thing for the younger age is first of all exposing them to the environment. Of exposing them to a different environment to what they have at home. This is one time in 10 days, like I can say 10 days, 10 days, camp, a week, 10 days, where they... For the whole rest of the time, they'll be exposed to the environment at home. We've got that week, 10 days.
with you 100%. Okay, remind me. I want to go with you through. You can have a walk through a home and explain the mitzvos that pertain to a home. Just clothing, the mitzvos of clothing, the mitzvos of the walls, the mitzvos. We'll discuss that. But let's continue. Eli.
I think that based on that, like you wanted to get kids, like wanted for just talking person on a individual level, like right now, like, in B'nai Akiva at home. In B'nai Akiva at home, it's not, it attracts a specific amount of people and it leaves out a lot of other kids that are less religious but still go, like are still Orthodox. But they're not attracted to Judaism on a too high of a level. And so I'm thinking, like, in order to be, like, to have a good impact in like, the community, is like through not through a very religious approach, not like full on, but through like relationships with the kids themselves, like, and also by presenting them. Like with the beauty of the religion, rather like just exposing them to like Shabbat and all this stuff, and Ruach, organizing, going into the schools and organizing, like presenting, I don't know, and I feel like just like presenting rather than sitting down, giving like hardcore like shiurim on Shabbat. Like I know personally that when they said come for a pula, like oh no, all I want to do is play soccer, right? A lot of the times I wouldn't go, and I just think like just a simple thing that a lot of kids would take with them, like a simple nice idea that we get about here, like just like a 15-minute story or something that just catches them and gets their attention. But once they start losing attention, they start losing interest in religion altogether, and they're connected. They're young and they're looking for fun, and they're not going to want to concentrate. Like some kids would want to concentrate, but others like they're looking for that quick type of feeling. You know, they're not looking to delve deep inside themselves at the moment. So I feel like in order to catch these kids, it's like to be very gentle with them, based on the relationship between the thing you are to be their role model, not necessarily in a religious way, but as a person as well. And they'll see you as a religious person who follows, rather than a person who follows prohibition, the person who is a good person. And yeah, that's what I think.
I hear. What happens when a child wants to advance? And you're assuming everyone's here. And what happens when a kid comes and says, explain it to me? Like he's saying, Ari's saying. You will have kids that are serious enough, and they say, and very often when a child does that, you have to search what's really going on behind the scenes. Sometimes his parents are going through a divorce, or who knows what. You have to stop and ask yourself, why is he looking to be so religious? Nothing wrong with it, I'm all for it, but you also have to see what the kid needs. So now a kid comes to you and says, I want to understand, what is tzitzit about? What are you going to do?
I'd probably, if the individual was serious about it, I'd sit down, if I don't know specifically about it, it's important for the person to know, but if he doesn't know, it's to organize it. Another person who does know that, in order that I sit down with him and learn with him. And another, let's just say I didn't know the answer, I'd sit with the kid, because if it's come to me, and with another person and learn with the child, in order that like you kind of doing it together. So like kind of thing, like with everyone knowing him.
You have people there?
You
have sources to tap? Meaning
in Israel,
right? No, there, you're going to be in Australia.
Well, like higher ranks than B'nai Akiva. Because I'm not like so knowledgeable in Judaism, where there are people on MTA or like people who have studied in Shiva for longer who would know more. It's like you don't know, if you don't know the answer, you go to something like you go to a higher source.
Okay. I think though that we have to take into account what Ari said. There is an aspect where we do have to explain. We can't just build relationships. Meaning you'll be a nice guy. There are other nice guys. To say that the whole religion will be based on his relationship with you, I think is going, I don't mean specifically you, I mean the person, I think is really weakening his, at least it's something. But I think we have to think in terms of what they said also, trying to get as much understanding as possible as we're doing things, and for that we need our own understanding, and B, giving experience. Not only I agree the relationship, but we're going to discuss. I put out a sheet. One of the things we have to recognize in life are our limitations. If you're what? I don't remember. And B was experience, to experience it. Okay, so the relationship is very important, and that's at the key of a lot of it. But at the same time, the relationship, what happens when you decide to fly out to Cambridge? Are you? It cannot be based on one person. Meaning, sometimes a guy comes over to you and says, I don't have food today. So you could tell him, okay, here's food, should. And then you tell him, and here's food for tomorrow. Or you could put him in touch with a soup kitchen where he'll always find food. I'm always a believer in finding a long-term solution. The fact that you gave him food is very nice. But did you solve his problem? Why don't you have food? Meaning we have to get to the root. And the same thing here. If they have no connection, we have to connect them to something bigger than the connection with ourselves. We might be a way of connecting. But you guys always have to. This is a big mistake the Madrichim sometimes make. They focus on their connection and then they move on in life. You guys are just starting. You might choose a different college. Right now you feel like you're investing everything into it. You have to lay foundations that will grow. The connection is very important, but it is also very, very limited.
My point is like more, I know how important it is, like that is just creating an environment in which people will want to come to. Like,
for sure.
That's what I'm saying. Like, a lot of people come to B'nai Kiva for the social aspect. Once you have a social environment, that's when you could. And then that's when you bring, like that's what initially brings people to B'nai Kiva. That's what I'm like, yeah, that's what brings at home, that's what brings people there. And they know that there's the religious aspect, and they're okay, they enjoy it because they are Orthodox, but it's not something that triggers them. And that's, once they're there, that's when you could approach you could have your approach on the learning aspect, like the teaching.
I hear that. I want you guys to think, we're continuing around the room, what are the challenges that these guys will face? Meaning, if we're trying to give them tools, so the first, no, that you guys as madrichim, you're going to have to give the chanichim. What are the chanichim going to face? What challenges are they facing? So you'll tell me, well, one guy's facing his father's abusive, another guy's facing his parents are getting divorced, the third guy's facing is being bullied in school. Fine, but I'm talking as Bnei Akiva. Now we're building a tochnit. We can't anticipate each individual's problem, but now when we look at the generation that you're dealing with, what challenges are they going to face, and what can we give them? So you guys are telling me connect to Judaism. Okay, fine. What about Judaism? And what will connect them and what will hold them? So I want us to think as we go around the room, and we'll continue going around the room, what challenges are they going to face and what tools am I giving them? Tzitzit happens to be a powerful thing. When a guy puts on a garment every day and he sees those strings, that's something, and it's also an action. Meaning sometimes when a person puts on tzitzit, it's a way of showing, I am more religious. And when he makes that step, technically, halachically, you want to put on tzitzit, you're performing a mitzvah. When you don't put on tzitzit, you didn't get that biblical mitzvah. It's not like every given moment you must wear tzitzit. It's that every moment that you do, you gain another mitzvah. So it's one of those mitzvahs where you want to get it. It's free for the taking. You buy a kosher pair of tzitzit. You have, now, we have over here Rav Ari Kaplan's book. You guys can quickly go over it and understand the technical aspects of how you make tzitzit and the halachic aspects. That one burnt, but I was told it's still usable. So I was told. So I'm just saying, that's an example. Let's continue going around the room, but I think you guys have to try to bring it down more down to earth. Not just up like Judaism. Okay, what? What are you going to tell them? So let's try thinking about that. Again, people said they need to purchase notebooks, so I got them for 4 shekel apiece. If anyone wants, I have here notebooks. If anyone wants, takes notes. Yes, sir.
What happens if you end up with a child or a group of children that come to like a machne at the end of the year, but they don't come to grow literacy, they just come for fun?
And
you want to convince them to obviously think about growing literacy, like how would you approach
that? So I'll get to that I have written down. I wrote a list of things, pointers, like as a madrich, what my recommendation would be. But I want to get to that end. I want first that we should think together What do you anticipate are your challenges? I've never been to New Zealand, I've never been to Australia, and I've never been to South Africa. So only you know what the challenges of the youth in your countries is. And bear in mind, you guys are only a few years away from marriage. It's not so far off that these are the challenges of your own kids. So it's not in 2 years, but it might be in 5 years, it might be in 7 years. You give it thought now, you're going to be preparing for it. Rail, we're with you. I'm listening.
I guess pretty much the whole thing, like, what I find is stuff with Nakiva, it's like pretty much capturing the movement to, like, everything through the year is working towards 3 weeks and the end of the year, everyone comes together. But like Israel said, lots of kids just come for fun. And I guess it's just putting in their mind, it's like, not that all they're going to come there to work, but can't do it, like, shit environment or whatever. It's like, you come also just to learn a little bit, just like to get, like, as David said, a little more understanding of different sides of Judaism. And maybe, like what Eddie said, if they hear one nice piece or something, they go for fun, they hear one nice thing, and it interests them, and they want to come and ask for something else. And I guess that's just that first step, making them a little interested in something.
Fine, but what happens next? What's the next step? Everyone here is talking about the first step. What's the next step? Kai comes and says, I'm interested. What are you going to tell him? Well, I don't understand why we're focused on the first step all the time. So fill me in. What am I missing?
People know the kids at home that we are weird around. The main problem that we have is getting the kids in the first place. Like, well, that's what we have.
Like yeah, but
it's like the initial. Well, right now, what we're facing is getting those kids initially, and then we're gonna think this. But right now, our main focus is getting the kids.
So let me tell you something. When I was a kid, there was no youth movement. There was no B'nai Akiva where I was growing up. There was literally just a void. The kids would go in the afternoon, play in the park, nothing. So I was maybe 14, 15 years old, and I decided I'm starting a youth movement. So I got permission from the local shul, and I started giving a class. We learned all of Tanakh every year. We learned stories from the Talmud. We learned Midrashim, Jewish history. You'd think, who's going to come to that? The answer is, because it was stories, and I got very, very delicious jelly beans. I would get flavored jelly beans. I don't know if they have that where you guys come from. You get jelly bean coconut flavor. I had maybe 50 different flavors. And that was my prize. It was unique. It wasn't something the parents were buying them. I had every Shabbos for like 2 years, I'd have another two kids coming. It reached a point where I started with three kids. Within 2 months, I had about 15. By the end, when I had to leave, by the end of 2 years, I had almost a full shul. I had like literally rows of kids coming, streaming to learn every Shabbat. And I think that one of the things that you guys aren't thinking about is how interesting the information can really be. You tell a kid a story, it's interesting.
I think it's different. You come from different backgrounds. Like, was your background a religious background?
I had a religious background, 100%.
Yeah, you see, we not, like, are living in South Africa, Australians and South Australia, so it's a religious background. Or like most Jews, we from Joburg and where we come from, are just traditional. They just do Friday night supper, have a good meal, and then later they'll probably have a kosher home, and they'll go to shul and yontifs, like that's it.
Watch. Okay? You guys, give me 5 minutes. I'm going to put on an act for you. This is a B'nai Akiva Peula. This is what I do for my kids when I put them to sleep at night or Shabbos afternoon when I have to tell them a story. So we'll start first what I don't do with my kids. We'll start with a peula that theoretically I would do if I was sitting in front of 7th graders or 9th graders. And then we'll go on. I'll tell you, and you tell me if this wouldn't attract an irreligious child. So I was on my way back here and I was thinking, what am I going to do with these guys? I haven't done B'nai Akiva in years. Come on, what do I know about B'nai Akiva? So I was fortunate enough to pass two very interesting specimens on the way. These two. And if I were to start a peula right now, I would just walk into the class or the room, quiet. Sometimes the less you say, the better. See these two? What's the difference between them? Notice, I didn't identify what they are. Let's just go around the room and each person will tell me what differences they see between these two. I'm holding, I won't say what I'm holding. Yes. Okay. Ari, what do you see here? What are the differences between these two?
I'm holding a leaf and a branch.
And what are the differences?
Yeah, brown one's green.
Okay, David, what are the differences?
Brown, yeah, the same, but the leaves are broken.
I broke them only on purpose, by the way, yeah? Ellie?
One has many little, like, leaves, one is just one big one.
Maybe one of the differences would help you in the world.
I don't get the purpose, eh?
What about looks poor? The dead.
The one on the right, the leaf is actually bigger, but it's sort of broken and like brown and dead, and the ones on the left like looks alive.
The ones draw that, the ones look very good.
One that's crunching, like have more like crunching than the other.
So you have one's in the left, one's in the right.
Oh. Do you notice that every one of your sentences could be the beginning of an amazing pula? Think about it for a second. If I want to talk about the tree of life, Torah, then I can talk about why is this green and alive and why is this not. If I want to talk about the individual as opposed to the group, I could talk about the big leaf and the branch with many leaves. If I want to talk about this being crunchy and this being not crunchy, why is this crunchy and this not? This has fluid. Mayim is Torah. It gives it life. This can shrivel. Will this end up like this? The bigger... You see the concepts that could evolve from this? If I just start the pula with this, two little leaves I picked up off the ground, it starts off much more interesting. Right? Now, so let's say he just said, one's on your left and one's on your right. If I wanted to develop that, then I would say yes. But that could change, right? From the left to right. So what do Chazal tell us? If our sages tell us what you see on the left is really on the right, what you see on the right is really on the left, Chazal say, well, wait a second, maybe you're just looking at it the wrong way. So in life, even when we see something and it seems totally wrong, it seems absurd. You know, when they initially started the theory saying that mass accelerates at the same speed, irrespective of its size, right? Gravity pulls everything at approximately the same speed. People said, you're nuts. Until they did experiments, and they said, don't bother doing experiments. Everyone knows things that weigh more full more swiftly, and then the experiments prove not that way, right? So what we see isn't always the way we think it is. And then we could evolve that into a conversation. You want to tell me that because a guy is not religious, he wouldn't be interested in that? I don't think so. I think it's a question of how you present it. So that's one. Now let me tell you what I do with my kids on a night that I get to put them to sleep, or on a Shabbos afternoon. But being that you're older, I'll tell you a more interesting and maybe a little bit more scary story that I wouldn't tell little kids. He was lying there with students all around him. He had no hands and no feet, and all he could do was talk. But all the students lay there close, trying to catch his every word. And suddenly he said, careful, we gotta get out of here. And the student said, what's wrong? And he said, this house is going to collapse on us. So the student said, let's take your bed out. And Rabbi Hanina and Nachum Ish Gamzu said, don't take my bed out first. You guys go out first and take me out last. And they said, but we don't want the house to collapse on you. And Nachum Ish Gamzu said, house is not going to collapse as long as I'm in the house. And so the students quickly filed out of the house until only four remained. They lifted his bed, they took him out of the house, and no sooner had they left the house that the house collapsed. And the students turned to him and they said, Nachum, our Rebbe, if you're so pious that you knew the house wouldn't collapse on you, why are you lying there like that? No hands, no feet, body covered with boil, suffering. And Nachum Ish Gamzu said to them, once I was carrying a series of camels laden with food. And as I started taking the load off the camels, a poor man came up to me and said, please, Rabbi, give me something to eat. And I said to the poor man, I will, give me just a minute. I figured the camels are suffering after a long journey, let me unload the camels. When I finished unloading the camels, I came back to give the poor man to eat and found that he had died of starvation. He was talking to me with his last morsel of strength. And as I stood there shocked and sorrowful looking at the body on the floor, I was overcome with grief and I threw myself on the body and I said, these hands of mine that weren't swift to give food to you, may they be cut off. These feet of mine that weren't swift to run and bring you the food you asked, may they be cut off. This body of mine that didn't have enough compassion for you, may it be covered with boils. And when I finished that, God started fulfilling the curses in me. And just as I cursed myself, that's what happened. I said, my hands should fall off, my limbs fell off, my feet should fall off, my feet fell off. And Be'ezrat Hashem, although I am suffering here, God will forgive me in the world to come. Our sages said that when the people of Jerusalem had to send a gift to the Roman emperor, they said, who do we send it with? Who can we entrust with this great, precious gift? None other than Nachum Ish Gamzu. For Nachum, whenever something happens, he says, Gamzu L'tova. This too is for good. You guys know the story about the chest and the sand? Don't know the story. So Nachum Ish Gamzu is en route to Rome, and he has a chest laden with jewels for the Roman emperor. And as he's going up to Rome, he stops at an inn, and the innkeepers come at night. You have here this cripple, they take advantage of it. And unbeknownst to him, they find a way of opening the chest, taking out all the jewels, filling it with sand and rocks. And when he comes to the Roman emperor, he says, your people, the Jews, have sent you a gift. And they bring the chest before the emperor, and the emperor is wistfully looking as they open the chest, and he sees a chest filled with sand. So he turns and he says, this is what the Jews send me? They're mocking me? Send him to be executed, and let's start making decrees against the Jews. One thing you guys should know, I was always known as the to-be-continued rabbi. Every story, when I'd reach a point of suspense, I'd stop and say, okay, we'll get back to it. The guys didn't leave. I didn't have people going out to the bathroom in the middle of my Bnei Akiva. It wasn't called Bnei Akiva. But I always left stories at this point, we'll get back to it. And for kids, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, even 19-year-olds, when you leave them at the edge of their seat, they stay there for a very long time. They're not going anywhere. So we'll get back to it. But you guys got the idea? This is not, you can't tell me that's not interesting. I haven't had a group where I told a story and they weren't caught by it. I did. It's not true. There was a group that the room was burnt down on Thursday night. And then when I came in Friday night and I tried to tell them a story about Rebbe and Antoninus, they just weren't with me. It was a shocker to me because this is probably one of the first times it ever happened to me that I tell a story about this. These two babies, the Roman and the Jew, they're switched. The Jew is almost killed for being circumcised and then they grow up, etc. Most people are interested by the story. Okay, you win some, you lose some. You can't take it to heart. But, most of the time you go with a story, people are with you. And you can't tell me that this is an issue of religion. It has nothing to do with it. But if you're telling them stories...
It's just getting them to actually... Yeah.
Who tells them stories? Nowadays you don't hear stories. You ever hear a good storyteller? Why did I bring Rav Ginsburg yesterday? I wanted to tell you guys stories. It's an amazing storyteller.
Is an issue that then the parents then the kids go. Because I've experienced personally trying to get kids to come into my dream last year, and parents would play and put the phone down on me. Like as soon as they heard that I was from Bnei Akiva, I had people put the phone down. I'm David from Bnei Akiva, I'm not the mean at all, and all of a sudden, as soon as the words Bnei Akiva come out, all of a sudden you're the arch enemy because you're like trying to convert their son from bed. To being a religious person.
So why not make a pula that has nothing to do with Bnei Akiva?
So not
at Nei.
The thing is that when you call, you can't just say that. Like, you can't just say, like, oh, it's Nei. Like, one wonder why you're calling.
No,
you
say, how are you? I'm calling about this week's Bnei Akiva.
You always have to...
Line, the line say,
no, I know, that's what I'm saying.
But...
I'll tell you what else you're supposed to do.
No, so I'm saying, why don't you guys do something that will entice the parents? Hi, Saturday night, all the kids are getting together. We're having a special, think of what to say. I don't know if arts and crafts interest them. Or bring in a special guest speaker. You got to do something that's going to attract them. Here they have pool.
Should we get the parents involved as well, though?
I always try to get parents involved. Why am I taking all your pictures and sending it to your parents? Because I don't know how many of your parents are happy that you're learning Torah and how many parents hate us for it. I have guys in Machon Nir that I know their parents are cursing me every day for learning with their kids Torah. Every day I know they're cursing me. But when I send them an email and I tell them, look at your son, he's doing so well, he's so intelligent, he's so bright, he's so successful, what can they tell me? So I get an email back, thank you so much. And you know what? They melt eventually. Eventually they melt. And if you invite the parents and if you send them things back, positive feedback, and I always try to avoid conflict with the parents.
No,
I think
it's
a big mistake where people think for religion, I fight with them.
Big failure to make it where I'm from in recent times that they have not involved the parents in that. They've managed, like, shut my view is sometimes they shut the parents out and just focus on the kids, and then the parents are like, oh, these are my children, they're getting up. It's really important to be
able to. Right, but you should not. Yeah. You should know you have an opening now, because parents, the generation gap between parents and kids, the generations have changed so much. The parents are just at odds trying to figure out, what does my kid want and how do I make him happy? If you will work with the parent, then very often the parent will be very happy to have you in the picture. And the truth is that once you get the ball rolling, just like Benny, I didn't go and call the parents. But one kid tells the other kid, hey, you know, Shabbos afternoon, why should you go to the park and just watch other kids play? You could come here, we have fun, we sing songs. The thing should sell itself. I always say, religious Judaism is so beautiful. If it can't sell itself, there's a problem. You're not doing it right. A person who comes and sees, enjoys the singing, hears the singing, that should be its own attraction.
I think the kids themselves, when they come there, they have a lot of fun. I think that a lot of the problem sometimes is parents who don't let their kids go. And I think that the thing is about getting them more involved rather than going for the kid, because parents are
like, sometimes you also have to keep them busy. Sometimes you have parents that you tell them, look, give them the assignments. Like, you do A, you do B. I have
responsibility.
That. Right. Give them responsibility, and sometimes it could be a responsibility that it's not so important. I walked in there and I said, could someone help me clean the blackboard? Between me and you, I came here 2 hours ago and started cleaning the blackboard. Then I said to myself, what am I cleaning the blackboard for? I have to show them how to get other people to do things. One of your strengths in Bnei Akiva will be if you can get other people to do things. Don't you pull the kid. Tell the kids you have friends. Don't you think it would be much more fun if they come? Why don't you talk to them? You are 10 times more powerful when you get other people to do things. When you do it yourself, you're limited. I purposely waited and asked someone, who wants to volunteer?
But
notice
no,
I didn't
I
ask a specific
agree.
Person.
I don't agree, because sometimes
I have more Michaels waiting here.
So
one second.
Just on that point, I'll be 2 seconds.
Yeah.
But sometimes when you do it yourself, it gets other people saying, look, he's a leader.
Right. For sure, there are things that are very do yourself. Yesterday, I was talking about it with some guys who I learned with. Notice, I never call people my students. Never. You'll never hear me call someone my student. Rabbi Kiva Eiger, who was the greatest rabbi of Europe, wrote that in the introduction to his responsa. If you ever find in my responsa that I refer to someone as my student, you should know it's an error. Someone added that to the responsa. I never in my life called someone my student. Who knows who taught whom more? And he was the greatest rabbi of Europe. All of Europe was asking him questions. But he said, I learn from people and people learn from me. I wouldn't ever have the goal to call someone my student. So, also with what you're saying. So, I was walking with guys I learned with. And there was a friend of mine needed help carrying about 30 boxes of grapes. They were very heavy. My back was aching this morning from it. I didn't ask them to help. I said, guys, do you mind waiting for me? It'll take me 5 minutes. So the guys, they all wanted us to continue talking. They waited. They saw me carrying the crates. I didn't ask them. They just came and carried also. You're right. Example is the greatest teacher. Sometimes. But there are things that if you can get people involved, say, hey, you take care of A, you take care of B, you're going to get much more done. When I came here, half the guys weren't here. I didn't go looking for guys. I will not go looking for guys on principle. I asked one of the guys, you want to let the guys know we're doing it? At the same time, instead of my looking for guys, I could spend time talking to guys. I didn't come here to spend my time looking for guys. Right? You come to Bnei Akiva. If you're going to spend your time looking for the kids and doing things like that, you're wasting your time. Your time has to be precious. You have to have something of value to give. If you really have something of value to give, you cannot waste it searching for kids. Let the kids do that. I'm not talking about the legal aspect. I don't know how that works. I was very careful with the legal aspects when I was doing it. The parents shouldn't say, oh, I sent my kid. He went roaming in the street. You were responsible. I made very clear guidelines. I'm not talking about the legal aspect that each person has to work on and book out. Michael, finally, we got back to you. Yeah.
Most of the time, when David said, I agree with David saying that you can get through that support and connection with the parents, but I think that you can gain that connection to the parents through the kids by, as Ellie said, with building. I think I personally think the most important thing is to make a personal connection with the kids, in the sense that they'll come to B'nai and they'll continue coming because, oh, hey, look, there's like an 18, 19 year old guy, oh, he's like cool, he's old, whatever, like that, and they'll keep coming, and then they'll go home to their parents and say, oh, you know, we went to B'nai for today, it was really, really fun. And although maybe you're not directly sitting the parents down in a meeting or calling the parents, or like, I don't know, maybe when you call them on the phone, like, oh, how are you, whatever, you can get this connection through the parents, through the kids, so that they go home and say to the parents, like, it was really fun, and then the parents have this, like, positive idea that, like, it's having fun on Sunday afternoon or Saturday night, or, like, where, I don't know, like, I'm seeing in terms of, like, I don't know what you think, in terms of, like, how to get these parents on board.
A few things. I think you have to know. I'm going to tell you now the secret to connecting to people. What I'm telling you now is something that will serve you in good stead if you learn to use it in job interviews, moving forward in your job, and in B'nai Akiva, if you'll choose to be counselors, whatever you do. The key to connecting to people is this: giving them attention. Now, you have to use social norms. There are some societies where you sit like this. There are some societies where you sit like this. You have to use the social norms. If you break the social norms, then you can really be offensive. The guy won't be comfortable. Most people have a yearning desire to be listened to and to be appreciated. They don't feel like the world knows how smart they are. Like Mark Twain once said, when people compliment me, I'm feeling inside of me, I'm upset that they didn't compliment me enough. And I'm embarrassed by the fact that I'm upset. That's what Mark Twain said about himself. He said, whenever I hear people compliment me, I'm always upset. I feeling they didn't say enough. And he said, and I think that's the way every person is. We all feel like no one really appreciates me. The world doesn't know what a great person I really am. Every person feels that. Now, if you could give any person the feeling that you really want to hear what they have to say and you really appreciate them, you've won their heart. And it doesn't matter if it's a parent who's very anti-religious. You know, I sit many times with people that are anti-religious. I listen to them. We have conversation. We will discuss later what to do with belligerent souls. People who are just adamant to be mean and have their own issues. I'm talking about people who just, I don't believe in this. I don't think it's right. I think this is an ancient thing. This is whatever people might say. You listen. You smile. Okay, I hear. You don't have to argue.
And then
look. The kids really have a good time. I understand. Look, our focus is on getting the kids together, learning to be good individuals, productive members of society. Talk the lingo, come on. Yeah, you gotta talk their language. But there's, if you've connected, if you've respected them and listened to them, and that's another point. You meet a parent. Parent is 55 years old or 45 years old enough to be your parent. And their name is, let's say, Matthew Schwartz. I'm a believer in giving them respect, Mr. Schwartz. I'm a big believer in that. Now, there are social norms. There are places where the person, I once had someone tell me, you're making me feel like my father. I'm not Mr. Schwartz, that's my dad. Fine. But I always feel better err on the side of giving too much respect than too little.
And then they can tell you, okay,
you can first
name.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
No, I think it's the honest.
Go ahead. Yes, sir.
It's about what you said, and I think you also talked about how you're trying to get people to come to the level that of Sefer Tel Aviv. That's not the problem. It used to be the biggest mission in Israel, like 500 people. Now they're about 70 people. And what they do all day is cry about the fact that no one wants to come. And all they do is think about how to get people to come. The fact is that when kids come, and all they're just trying to get them to come, and then they come, and they don't see anything valuable, but all they see is games and like, fun stuff that's obviously attractive, yeah, and they like it, but in a certain time, if they don't get what they're expecting to get in B'nai Akiva, and they see that all it is only games, and you're all the time only trying to get them to come. So first thing, they could start to control you by the fact that they know that all you want to do is get them to come. That could be one problem. Another problem is just they don't find what they're expecting to find, so they just leave. And then it's a kind of a circle that all of them only try to get kids to come. The kids come and don't find anything, and that's what they say. The other way around, do something valuable, which they expect to see there, obviously in an interactive way, yeah, an attractive way that they want to come, not a boring way, but if you do something that's giving them a bit values and information or whatever. The second, like, a few kids come and then they see there's something and their friends see that something's happening, they'll automatically come. It's the other way around.
It's interesting though, because I don't know, I think that a lot of the kids in New Zealand anyway, and I would assume like South Africa, that the main reason that they want to come is, and they find value in having fun. Like, I think the problem that we really face is having that fun aspect and getting kids like coming. Like, you can do fun things like timber bowling or like movies or whatever like that, but also balancing up with something more valuable and the main thing that they want to do. Because I don't know, I see that a lot. The thing is because like a lot of the kids back home aren't necessarily religious and they still come to B'nai, the connection that I make there is that the main reason that, is that they come to B'nai is maybe more for the social reason than necessarily the religious reason. Because okay, so maybe they don't necessarily have the means to become more religious, but there's certain things that they can do that they do. So I think that the social thing plays a huge part, and I think the real challenge is keeping them interested and giving them that value.
I want to share with you an argument. Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, like keeping these kids interested and coming, giving them something of value that's not just, oh, fun.
So I came, the first class that I officially taught, classroom, was a class of guys. One guy had two parents retarded. Another guy was, I mean, I don't know if he was a kleptomaniac, but he had certain problems. I mean, at one point I told his father, you better start saving up for bail money. Another guy committed suicide a few years ago. He had his issues. Really a colorful class, we could call them. And it was at a point where every teacher said, we're not touching that class. So you have this class that's supposed to enter a certain grade, and all the teachers said, we're not teaching that class, forget it. So young old me went over to the principal and said, I'll teach him on the condition that you back me whatever I do. If you back me, if you let me be tough with them, discipline, do what I think I have to do, then I'm willing to take him on. One of the things that I did with the class, there are a lot of things I did with the class, and this is a class that stayed in touch with me years onward. Years. I mean, for years they would come of their own volition every Shabbos to learn for class. These were, you could call them religious kids. They didn't know Aleph Beis. I mean, they didn't know anything. They came from religious homes, but no one ever succeeded in teaching them much. So I taught them Parsha on the highest level. I taught them everything on the highest level. But you know what? When you talk to people and you give them things that are deep and they see you know what you're talking about, they're attracted. One of the things I did was I told them Thursday night I want us to go to a soup kitchen, to an organization called Tomchei Shabbos, where we put food together for the needy, boxes of food for the needy. So what was the first question our generation asks? What are you going to pay me? So I said nothing. So they said, why should I go? And I said, because there are poor people that need food, and you're going to work to get that food to them. And everyone who heard that was my plan said, it's going to flop. Why would the kids go? And I said, no, the exact opposite. It will succeed because the kids are thirsting for something of value. We live in a society where we keep telling the kids, do this and you'll have fun. Do this and you'll make money. Do this and things will be good for you. What about do this because it's a good thing to do? What about do this because this is the right thing to do? There is a right and wrong in the world. They won't hear that. They won't hear that in school. And they won't hear that in the workforce. Where are they going to hear that if not in Akiva? There's an aspect where if you tell a kid, this is a mitzvah, this is what God wants us to do, and it's a good thing to do, that's why you should do it. That's the reward. There's a world to come. There are a lot of other things. But this is why. You know what? Every kid came, and not only did every kid come, they kept begging me all year long to do it again and again. I was having fights with them. They would keep saying, let's do it again, let's go again, let's go again. Kids can connect to something real. We live in a world that everything is fake. A kid says, I want to have fun, Dad, get me the Nintendo, get me the game system. He gets the game system. He spends 2 hours in front of me. Yeah, I got a high score, great. How much satisfaction does he have? How good does he feel about himself?
I think that he feels pretty good about himself.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, like
Four stars.
No, but I mean...
Four stars.
Do you want another game?
Yeah, I agree with you, okay, because it's talking about temporary satisfaction, but you're talking about a kid that maybe necessarily has an interest stage where they can enter target.
I think that you don't have to define it for them. But if you give them something real, then you're the only one offering that to them. We have a choice in Bnei Akiva now. Are we going to go the way of the world and keep giving them cheap thrills? Or are we going to give them something real? Now, it's very enticing to try and give them cheap thrills. It's very enticing. Sure, I'll get them pizza, I'll take them bowling. Then what am I doing? I'm playing the game the rest of the world is. I am the one place where they could get something real. And you know what? The second you can connect with them and give them that real, and they realize that they're getting it here, they will want to come back. When they'll have a question, should I have an abortion or not, who are they going to go ask? If you're the guy who's going bowling with them, so why should they ask you? If you're the guy who's spending time and saying, is there a God? Are there things that are right and wrong? Do we care about doing what's right in the world? I'm with you. I think it's, on the one end, yeah, for sure we have to keep it fun. But we have to remember that our goal is not only let's keep them connected, but let's get them to understand.
And that's what I'm asking, because like, I don't know, it's a hard thing to do.
You have to make the real, to be attractive. That's obvious. You can leave the real boring, but you have to stay real. You can't be only attractive and not sell anything. I mean, you can't do a commercial that's beautiful and get everyone to come to buy, but you're not selling anything.
This is the problem, that this is hard to keep.
Obviously, it's hard.
For sure, it's hard.
You just be attractive, but then you just stick with nothing.
So that's why I gave you the example. We'll get to that. I have a whole list of rules that I just put together now in the last hour, what I would say are important rules in order to connect well in Bnei Akiva. Yeah?
I've got a question with respect to the Chanichim of the Ma'atrachim. Okay, so, like, especially at Baptist art camps in Machane in South Africa, the Ma'atrachim are normal people. Like the Chanichim see them as something different. So I'm very worried that because at our camp you have to wear a kippah and you have to do everything if you want to be a Mahdi or whatever. But what happens if I'm a Mahdi at camp and I'm wearing my kippah and I'm doing everything and I'm being a good model, but then a week later the Chanichim see me on the beach in Cape Town, sitting on the beach, you know? The older Chanichim see me out one night in town, going out to a club or whatever, you know? I'm not going to change who I am just so I can be a Mahdi. And it's fine for it's fine if you're the older kids, because the older kids understand that you're actually a real human being and you go out and you're a normal person. But for the younger kids, they don't understand it.
I think you have to think about that. I can tell you that the halacha says that there are certain things that when you're in a position of leadership, you cannot do. You're not allowed to purchase something and say, oh, I'll pay you later. People say, what do you mean? You're not paying him? He worked at your house? You're trying to cheat him? There are certain levels, depends on what level the person's on. But there are certain things that you cannot do if you're in a position of leadership. And if they're looking up to you, you're hurting not only yourself.
You can be that, you can do those things while you're the leader. But what happens when camp's over and that's your normal lot?
I was in high school, my whole class was contemplating smoking. My father smokes, my grandfather, may rest in peace, smoke. I come from a long line of smokers. If I would have wanted to smoke, I had all the cigars I wanted. I had a friend who started smoking. And my father said, here, taste what a good cigar is like. So I had access to it. And you know what? I still today want to smoke. I like smoking. When someone stands next to me and he's smoking, I enjoy it. I would want to smoke. But I knew that in my high school class, I wasn't the rabbi, but I was one of the top guys in the class. And religiously, I had a certain position. You know who are the class leaders. I knew if I smoke, so I might smoke maybe once a week. But if anyone ever sees me, they'll all say, oh, he's smoking, so I could smoke. And who knows what they'll smoke, whether it'll be pot or weed or other things. Never started smoking. I you could say, what responsibility do you have? The answer is, you do. If people are looking at you, they'll learn from you. You do. You don't have a choice. You're coming back to your community, and you're the one wearing a kippah. And people say, ah, so you must know stuff. You're the religious guy. Let's ask him the questions. Even if you don't know the answers, the way you behave is reflective on all of Judaism.
What happens if it's not you, but you still want to be a Mahdi and help out, and you think you could help and be a good Majid? But that's not you. It's only, but for those 3 weeks, you can put in a kippah and you can not change yourself, but just abide to the rules of the day and still help out. And the kids enjoy it. Because afterwards and before, you're not that lucky. It's not that you're not that person, but you just don't follow the rules that you would on the camp.
Because at home, a lot of us, when we came,
I think you have to think about it. You guys have to think about it, because I try not to preach anything that's not real. I don't see the point in it.
Yeah, but then you're just losing Madrachim who want to help out but can't because of that kind of rule.
I didn't say a rule, but you guys have to think about it.
Look,
I don't have an answer for you off the cuff. I also have to think about it. You think about it, I'll think about it. If you don't mind, I'll ask Rav Nerio what he thinks about it. Is that okay with you guys?
Yeah.
Because I think it's a very fair question. I don't have an answer for you right now. I have to think about it. Meaning,
The thing is, there are Madrachim there in our camp. Like in every camp there are. But it's the older kid to understand, okay, he's a real person, he does go out, he does drink or whatever. Yeah, it's like mostly the younger kids.
I he's involved in
Well, the question is when it contradicts. Meaning, to do it as well is admirable. To do it when it's either this or that, so you're basically telling the kid one thing and doing differently.
That's why I said initially, that's why I said based on the strength of the relationship. Because then
that could be much as well.
Why? Well, you're not doing anything wrong by doing, you go out as a person, as part of just normal life, not being a bad person, going out and being involved in my life is about being a bad person.
So I'll tell you guys in a second, but I think there are a lot of guys who want to say stuff. Let's just see what each guy says. Yeah, sir. Try to answer that. Guys, I'll get to your questions in a second, okay? But I want to answer that with the sheets I wrote, with a few basic elements. I'm going to give out the sheets in a second. The printer just ran out of ink, so I only have a few copies. If you guys want more copies, let me know. I'll make more copies. But I want to... Let's see if people want it. Who said you guys want it? I wrote the lines in Hebrew, really they're quotes. And then, but thank you. But I think there are basic concepts in any educator's responsibility, and basic concepts that will help any person connect. And if you think back, there are concepts that I worked by when you guys showed up. So we'll give out the sheets, and then we'll work it. But as we give them out, I want to begin with the first point. Who remembers how we began our first meeting? 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago?
Marriage.
Nope. Before that. How did we begin our first time here? When we sat together?
Names.
You can get up and lecture, and then you're just talking. If I want to listen, I'll listen. When I showed up to the first class I taught, that class that I told you about earlier, so I'm teaching for a few minutes, and a kid pipes up and he says, "Rabbi, you ever teach a word before in your life?"
A what?
Did you ever teach a word before in your life? And I smiled and I looked at him and said, "Never taught a thing in my life, never plan on teaching a thing in my life, but you and I are going to spend the year together in this classroom, and I will learn in this classroom. If you choose to join the learning experience, so be it. I will try to make it as entertaining and enticing as possible. But I never taught and never plan on teaching. I do not think you could teach a person anything. A person can only want to learn. And you can only try to present the information in a way that he wants to. You're not coming there in your 3 weeks to teach them anything. If your goal is going to be to teach, I don't want to listen. But if your goal is, hey, this is interesting, this is fun, this is fascinating, let me share with you something I heard that I find interesting. How did I begin when I told you about Nachum Ish Gamzu? I said, I have a story that I think is just fascinating. I'm excited about it. My excitement resonates. And that's the first point you guys have to know. The more you have, the more you can give. The more you have, the more your personality will give, because that's who you are. If all of Judaism is something theoretical, so then that's what the kids see by you. Okay, it's a theory. I could go to college and study it also. But if you're living it, or you're trying to live it, and you should know, even if you haven't attained the greatest knowledge, but you have a real thirst, a real yearning to attain it, you're trying to attain it, that if you have that, the kids will catch that. If the kids catch that, you've given them the greatest gift. The question is, what's your attitude to it, and what are you doing about it? This isn't a game. It's like in marriage. A wife asks her husband, "Do you love me?" "Yes." "Do you really love me?" "Yes." "But do you really love me?" "Yes, I do." Why is she asking? Because she obviously doesn't feel that. Our wives connect with who we really are. It's more complicated than that. But in general, our spouses sense who we really are, and the people we try to teach sense who we really are. And let's begin. Sorry, I don't have enough copies. If you guys want, we'll make more copies. There's one on the table. Okay. What? Who wants another copy?
Just the machine upstairs.
Yeah. It's in the lobby. In the entrance.
Huh?
In the entrance.
Yeah.
How many copies do we want?
Four.
Okay.
Four.
What?
In the next room, it came down. Okay, we have like a plan thing every week for Nekiva. Like, we get 20 people to come. It's like incredible. Like, that's including my group.
Okay.
And then like, but it's like the people that do come look like 5 for all the kids, not the young kids. Like, we lose the people. And also, like a friend of mine, she went to Nekiva for like 5-year camps or whatever, 5 years, and she came on a year program at the end of the year. And like, She was never religious anyway, she came from a traditional background. And then like I said, come to your program, come whatever, get involved in Nekiva, so she came. She went back, she wasn't like religious or anything. And she wanted to be a Madrachah on campus, she enjoyed it. And they said, "No, we don't want you because you're just not religious." So it's like kind of, you're part of them your whole life, and you get to a stage and you want to get something back, and they just leave you hanging and saying, like,
so let's.
They say that if you don't change, if you don't become this absolute model of our ideology, then you can't help the kids.
that's something we could discuss, but I think we'll get there. That's let's begin here. Yeah. Think again, going back to what we said earlier, if you have something real to offer, it talks. I mean, that's where you guys have to be creative. But something real is going to talk for itself. I think that a lot of B'nai has become fluff. And if you're fluff, well, I got better fluff at the supermarket. I can go to the bar, I can get it much better than anything you got to offer. How good do the girls look in B'nai? If that's the key, well, I got better girls somewhere else. If I'm trying to attract the guys because of the girls, so then the guys are going to look and say, wait, they're better looking girls somewhere else. If my goal is, look, I'll make you comfortable. You guys are used to being boys and girls, fine. I'll put boys and girls, but my goal is not that. I'll tell to you from a Haredi example. Haredi, in the Haredi institution, we have on Shabbos afternoon that kids get together and they say Tehillim. So you have one madricha who comes in and says, kids, today we're going to say Tehillim, and I have such a delicious candy for those who say Tehillim nicely today. I went to the store and looked for the most delicious candy. I'm going to be looking to see who says Tehillim nicely, and they will get this candy. I looked in one store and another store, and I finally found the good candy. So the kids come to that group, and they say Tehillim, and they get the candy, and they're disappointed, and their numbers come down. Another madricha comes in and says, kids, we're going to say Tehillim today. And you know what? There are Jews suffering in Russia. They're being persecuted. There are Jews that are in the hospital right now and they need God's help. We are saying Tehillim not for us. Our Tehillim is so important. Hashem and Shemayim is stopping everything He's doing and He's stopping and He's listening. He wants to hear what we have to say. And let's try to have as much Kavanah as we can. We'll each focus and we'll have in mind, let's each adopt one person. You daven for the soldier that's out in the front lines waiting in an ambush and he needs God's help not to be shot in the head. You daven for that person who's in an operation now, and they have to come out okay. You, each one, let's focus what we're davening on, and Hashem will really enjoy our Tehillim now. We're all going to get together and davening. And you know what? Even though our Tehillim is so, so important, I still thought it would be a nice idea to reward everyone at the end of the day, so I brought candies for everyone. That madricha has 10 times as many kids coming. Each week more kids come, because she gave meaning to what they're doing. If you're going to try to give the meaning to the candies, be it the looks of the girls or the games you're playing with it, you're not going to win because there are always better games. But if you're going to remember that all these side attractions, they're side attractions, they're very good. They're important, they have to be there. If you're not going to have it, they're not going to come. But what you're really serving them, like Aaron said earlier, is not the fluff, then you know what? You're the only one who's offering that to them. They're not going to get it anywhere else. Yeah?
What happens if done that and you try like your best to get people to come, but then there's that one person in the group of friends that let's say that has the power of the group, and he they all have a name, he's there as well, and he's he's influencing them. Like, not
even that's
saying,
not cool.
I'm not going to, I'm not going to Sharia, like, why are you going? And then they all go there, they actually want to come. But they're that guy in the group. It's just, let's tell them not to go, and they all get in.
We haven't started the sheet. That's at the bottom of the page. So we'll get to that. Let's begin at the top. First, Ehov et... I'll try to print out more. I have more ink. Meanwhile, look on with one another. If you want, take notes on it. And then we'll print out more. Our sages tell us in Pirkei Avot, Ehov et amlacha usna et rabanut. A person is supposed to love work and hate positions of authority. Remember, Ibn Akiva, you might be a madrich. Put yourself down. Don't be on top. If they'll choose to give you the status, they'll give you the status.
Yeah,
status is given, not taken.
In B'nai, South Africa, a lot of the madrichim are at camp and they're in it just to be at the top. Just to get like the best role.
So that's what we began with. Snat Rabbanut. A person has to hate positions of leadership, of authority. If I'm here, I don't have a choice. It's one of the things that bothered me when we were having our group Shabbos in the park. So my son saw everyone sitting around and I'm standing in the middle. So he said, so you're the ganenet. You're the kindergarten teacher. I want to be the kindergarten teacher. So you saw he came standing around busybody with his candies and said, I'll give this one, I'll give that one. Let's see who's behaving nicely. So you guys thought it was very amusing. And I said, I have a chinuch problem here. He's viewing the position of the rabbinate. My father's a rabbi, so... That means I could tell people what to do. Everyone's sitting around me like the kindergarten teacher. I have to think how to alter his view on that. So right now he's poor. I have time. I'm not so worried. But I still have to ensure that he doesn't get a skewed view of things. When you're entering Vnei, don't be happy to be the madrich. You're happy if you have something to offer, good, if you could help. But not as the one who's on top. The first point that I think we have to remember is Ohevet am briot umkavan laTorah. That's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Love God's creatures. People sense if you like them or not. I told you I was a magician in my youth. One of the first rules as an entertainer is love your audience. If you don't love them, they will sense it. There's no way you could fake it. The only way you can succeed is if you really, really care for the people you're working with. And they'll sense it. If you don't care how to fake, you can't fake. If you stop and you think, wait a second, these are kids, this is the only opportunity they have, and you invest. You say, okay, well, how can I make it best for them? You stop, you prepare, you invest work, they'll see it. People see if you invest in them. You guys don't know what I've done for you. You don't know. All you see is the sheets. You don't know that yesterday I was running around printing up CDs in case you guys would want to buy CDs. I never printed up CDs. First time in my life, I printed up CDs of the question and answer sessions I had, because I figured, you know what, you guys are going, some of you are staying, some of you are leaving, you might be interested in these questions. These are 200 questions over the last 3 years that guys have been asking. So I went, it's a special printing place, I printed it. You guys saw me running around, that's why I couldn't stay for Rabbi Ginsburg's class. You guys don't know it, but you sense it. You sense when someone is putting their strength and their efforts to make things work for you. The guys will sense the same thing. People sense it. The alkol pesha'im techase ava. King Solomon said in Mishlei, love can cover all rebelliousness, all faults. Remember that. A guy walks into Bnei Akiva and he's very loud. What are you going to do with this guy? So, your point, right? If you really care, then the fact that you care will give you a good eye for him. A guy once asked Rabbi Feinstein the following question. He said, I'm dating a girl and everything seems right, so I think I should get engaged, but I know she has certain faults. I know that she has certain faults, but now I want to marry her. So now they don't bother me. 10 years from now, who knows whether it'll bother me or not. So Rabbi Feinstein said, Bezrat Hashem, the relationship will work, and then your love will only grow. When your love grows, then her faults will bother you less. They won't bother you more. You enter marriage so that love will grow from the beginning. The beginning is just the starting point. It's not the ending point. In the Western culture, it's the ending point. That's it. From there, it's downhill. Her looks go down, everything goes down, and then you're just going from this point to this point. In Judaism, we say you're building something. It's just the beginning. You're just starting the building. That's why we're rejoicing, because you're starting. So the same thing when a guy walks into B'nai, the question is, how do I look at him? Do I look at him as the guy who, he's going to be the toughie? Or do I look at him as the guy who's got tremendous potential and let me see how I can take it out of him? Every guy has potential. I can tell you that through the years that I've learned with people, the people who always produced the most were the people who you least expected it from. If you treated them well. I once had a guy stop me in the street and he tells me, "Thank you so much." I say, what did I do? He says, "I came to your camp. I used to run a day camp. And I had a stutter. So we'd read Gemara, and I'd always offer every kid to read from the Gemara. This guy had a stutter, so it was a massive stutter. He would he'd start the Gemara, we'd sit there in class for like minutes on end with his stuttering till he could get a word out. So the first time I didn't know he had a stutter. No one bothered telling me this. So read me Gemara. I call each kid. You want to read? Yes, they read. You want to read? Yes, they read. I call on him, "Do you want to read?" "Yes." We wait. The class starts snickering. We wait. After about 2 or 3 minutes, he got one word out, and then everyone was like ready to applause, and then he started stuttering again. And it took a long time till he got his line done. So after class, I called him out. I said, "Look, if you want to read, we'll all wait. But I don't want to embarrass you. If you want, I won't call on you. Tell me what you want." So he said, "No, call on me." A year or two later, I'm meeting him in a supermarket, and I didn't remember the story. I'm telling you the story the way he told it to me. I didn't remember it. He told me that summer changed his life. Ever since then, he could read publicly. The fear caused him to stutter. The stutter caused him to have more fear, so he stuttered more, so he was never able to read publicly. If you would have asked me the first day, I don't remember that day. But I am certain that I would have said, I dread the day, every time calling on him. It's a waste of time. I'm sitting here waiting for him to finish stuttering. Would I have known then where he would get to? No, you don't know. And the same thing, I tell you many stories of guys who were belligerent, guys who did everything to destroy the class. But when approached with warmth and when they recognized, "Hey, I like you. So I know you're a troublemaker. I know you're going to try to make my life miserable." Think about what happened when we were sitting together over the 2 weeks. Guys did all kinds of things. Come on, we know what happened in the last 2 weeks. Guys sometimes threw a crack. The question is, how are you going to react? If you say, If you say a line, let's think of an example. I don't know. If you say something and a guy makes a joke of it, you have two choices. You can laugh, and then you're friends. You could smile, or you could take offense. Laugh, smile, you've won. You have won. If he's upset you, you've lost. And the key to it is, if I loved him, then it wouldn't bother me as much. Al kol psha'im techase ahava. And the last point to remember is what King Solomon told us, last point in our introduction here. Nachla mevohelet b'rishona, when you try to do something in haste, v'achita lo tevorach. Ultimately, you will not be blessed. You want to succeed in doing something, you have to plan it out. Don't try doing things haphazardly. You want a good pula, think about it in advance. Prepare. The next point is, make it work. Very often we're saying, this isn't an ideal situation, this isn't going to work. Bottom line, you've got to make it work. You're never going to have the ideal situation. You never have the ideal yeshiva, you never have the ideal group. Nothing's ever ideal in life. Either you make it work or you don't. It's up to you. You want it to work? Make it work. If you don't make it work, it's not going to work. You're never going to have ideal. If you're going to wait for the ideal situation, it's never going to happen. So don't fight City Hall. If you see all the cards are stacked against you, the kids are wailing, it's hot, it's cold, there are mosquitoes biting everyone, there's one kid who's picking on everyone, there's another kid who just made in his pants, the parents are calling in and complaining, that's not the time to have a pula, right? To figure out how to keep the kids busy. You do have to choose the times to do things. But at the same time, you can't always wait for the ideal time. Chazal tell us, "En ani ela bedad." There's no poverty other than in knowledge. If you have knowledge, you're not poor. He who has this, maletle, what's he lacking? He who lacks this, maitle, what does he have? If you have knowledge, what can you be lacking? If you lack knowledge, what could you be having? Remember that. The key here is, what do you know? If you invest time to prepare, it will succeed. When I gave this class when I was 14 or 15 years old, I used to spend 3 or 4 hours to give a 45 minutes piula. Yeah. You know, I give a 1 minute class every night. At the end of all our classes, we have 1 minute on davening in memory of a friend of ours who drowned, leaving no family behind. A ger, who drowned in a diving accident in Egypt. We call it Dov's minute. So after he died, we decided we'd add 1 minute of learning. To prepare that 1 minute, how long do you think it takes me? 1 minute on davening. Huh?
Half an hour.
Half an hour. Many times I spend a half hour preparing 1 minute. 1 minute sometimes takes me a half hour. It takes time. If you're going to do something well, you have to invest time and prepare. Yeah?
Like in this day and age, kids are used to having everything given to them and put in front of them, especially the Jewish kids in South Africa are very spoiled. So they're not going to do your hard work and everything. They expect, they'll expect your hard work to be done for them. They want it. Like, I don't think they'd really, like, they might appreciate it, I don't know, but I think they'd expect it anyway. So what if you put all your time and effort into like a pula, and it's just something they're not interested in?
Be flexible. What did I do when I came here?
So what do you have to do? You have to read the audience.
You for sure have to read the audience, for sure. And you have to be flexible. And you have to constantly try to have what to give. The question is, what do you have to give? Meaning, I don't think it's right that all you have to give is the connection. What do you have? Have you read the stories of Chazal? Learn halachot. I brought you guys Sfarim. Know it. If you know it, you have what to give. If you have nothing to give, or you have very little to give, that's when teachers are stuck. That's when you have lousy teachers and lousy madrichim.
Don't you think you need the connection first to see what the kids actually want? Or you can start teaching?
Yes and no. They don't know what they want. How's he supposed to know how...
On a religious view, if you get to know them, and then you get to know what they want to know, and if they want to know things, you can get to know exactly where they are in life, rather than just delving into a pula.
For sure. For sure. Agreed.
So the connection to Ma'at, I think, also the most important thing.
I agree. I agree. But it can't end there. It's a tool. You got to move from there. That can't be the focus. And even with the connection, you got to be able to move. What did I do? I came, they told me to give one class. I started talking, I saw no one was with me. So we just switched classes. Think back. The first two classes, that's how it went. I started in one direction. I was told to give a class in one direction. I came and I said, that's not what the guys want. So I at one point, I don't know if you remember, I stopped the class and I said, guys, what do you want? You don't want this point, so tell me what yes. And I tried different directions. And you don't always succeed. You win some, you lose some. The basis for a relationship, Chazal told us, is Hevei mekabel et kol adam besever panim yafot. Greet everyone with a warm countenance. You know what a difference it makes if you walk in and someone smiles at you? Think about it. What are you looking at him like? Sometimes you're the only person that's going to smile at him in the day. Think back to your own home. How often did your parents smile at you? How many times can you remember your parents smiling at you? How many times can you remember your friends smiling at you? We live in a world where people don't smile at you. They will laugh. They will be sardonic. They will be sarcastic. They will not smile at you. When was the last time someone said, I'm so happy you came? You don't hear that today. A child needs to hear that. I always tell my guys, Machon Meir, sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name. You guys know Cheers? They still play it on TV? Back when I was a kid, that was on.
Frasier.
Huh? Frasier. Oh, very good. Okay, so in my time it was Cheers. So the song, the opening song was always, sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So I think that's a big thing. If you can make Bnei Akiva that, you've already gotten step one. And the key to that is, how do I welcome them? And that goes back to the first point we discussed. We said people are dying to be heard. People are also dying for the feeling someone likes me, someone values me, someone appreciates me. Right, we'll take a point aside. You're giving a class, and guys aren't listening. Notice how he's listening. Physical contact automatically gets you without saying a word. I didn't ask him to listen. I didn't say we weren't listening earlier. I just meant to give an example that if you touch a person, he will look at you. And this is also a very important tool when you're teaching classes where there are kids with special needs. Sometimes a kid is riling up. All he's doing is asking for attention. You can stop the class and give him attention. Or as you're talking, you can walk near him and put your hand on him. The kid will automatically quiet down. I've seen this happen many, 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 many times. Physical contact is something you have to learn how to use. But you should also know that everyone that I know of, I don't know how it is in your part of the world, but in the United States, there's homophobia. You will not see men hugging or touching one another. People are very scared of physical contact with other men. And that's caused a very abnormal situation where most men are living in this perpetual need for physical contact. God created us in a way that we do need it. We cannot live without touching other people. But we don't do it. Because what does that mean? As a madrich, you have to know not to exploit it, not to overuse it, but at the same time, it is a very powerful tool. When you talk to someone and you put your hand on them, you've gotten their attention, you've made contact much more than if you just speak to them and you haven't made physical contact. But I'll tell you something I did in a class. I was giving a test, and I told you this was a very special class. So one of the kids keeps finding out, I can't read this. I figured the kid needs attention. So I walked next to him, and when I looked at his test, I put my hand on his shoulder, looked at the test. No sooner did I do that, that the kid next to him says, I can't read this either. So I said, okay. I walked next to him, I figured I'll be fair. I put my hand on his shoulder, looked at his test. I do that, and suddenly the next kid is doing it. So I said, no, this can't be. So the third kid, I put my hand on his shoulder, but I started asking myself, what's going on? These were good kids. Like now went to the good kids. And I finished with that kid, and the fourth kid comes and says he needs my help. So I decided, you know what, let me test if this really works. So I walked over to the fourth kid and looked at his test without moving my hand. And I'm telling you the way it happened. As I'm looking, I feel my hand being taken and placed on his shoulder. He literally took my hand and put it on his shoulder. And if you ask me, do I think he was consciously doing it? I'm not sure. I don't know. It could be it was just like, you know, a kid in 7th or 8th grade is still at that stage where he could be very natural and not even think about it. There is this need. Don't exploit it, but know how to use it. Chazal taught us, kamayim hapanim lapanim ken lev ha'adam la'adam. See, now, I could disregard it. Or I could say, hey, you know, that's really getting guys' attention. When we finish, now if you guys were younger, what I would say is, why don't we have a contest and see who could do it and balance it for the longest time? I take the shtick and I work with you. I'm not coming and saying, hey, don't do that. It's distracting everyone. I'm saying, it's a great idea. Let's do it afterwards. When I was teaching younger grades, so if I was in the middle of class and one kid would like bark at another, and I saw I lost the class's attention, so I'd say, hey, you know what? You bark really, really well. Let's stop now for 2 minutes and have a barking contest. And I'd go around the classroom, each kid would bark. They got it out of their system, now we could continue. Sometimes don't fight them, go with them. What'd you lose? You didn't fight them, they got what they needed out of the system, and you could continue. Chazal told us, "Velo akapdan melamed." If you're too to the T, you cannot teach. If people are pressured, you cannot teach them. People have to feel comfortable with you. So you have to think how to make them comfortable. And the same thing is true with Judaism. How are you going to make them comfortable with it? When people come to my house, they do things that are prohibited. A guy sits down and eats without making a blessing. It's prohibited to eat without a blessing. I don't tell him anything. Yeah, we have guests, sometimes they come with their wives, and they're not dressed modestly. I don't say anything. We have a Seder at our house. We once had a Seder, a guy who I thought was learning for quite a while brought a bottle of wine. And in the rush, there were so many guests, I forgot to check the bottle. So we're all drinking our 4 cups of wine on the Seder night, and suddenly one guy comes over to me and says, it's not kosher for Passover, the wine. So I almost threw up on the spot. Like, huh? So I look at the bottle, and I don't see a kosher for Passover sign. So I didn't have a choice. Halachically, we couldn't be drinking that wine. So I apologized profusely to the guest. I said, look, I'm very, very sorry. I don't see that it says it. We're going to have to empty out the cups, clean it off, and re-drink it. Now, I felt terrible. I think I'm sitting at the Seder, and I'm drinking wine, and I find out it's not kosher for Passover. Turns out at the very end of the Seder, I looked again at the bottle, and they just wrote it on dark red ink, and the background was light red ink. And you couldn't see it. But when you look really, really closely in better lighting, you can see it said kosher for Passover. It just wasn't written clearly. But most of the time, lakapdan milamed. If you're going to stick to the T, you can't teach. You ask your child, pick up the blocks. The kid picks up most of the blocks. And then he gets sidetracked. You could come back and say, hey, I told you to pick up the blocks. Or you could say he's 4 years old. He did it. He got sidetracked. I also get sidetracked when I do things. I can't hold him to the T. So we have to remember when to turn a blind eye. Very often, our job as a madrich is not to get involved. I don't have to hold them to the T. And they, if guys come in late and they're doing things that are not 100%, I don't always have to react. A guy takes a soccer ball and he's playing in the Beit Midrash. Maybe it's my job to tell him, hey, you know, Beit Midrash is supposed to respect, don't play the soccer ball. Maybe it's my job to walk out and not see it. Maybe I shouldn't be the one to react. You should think 10 times before you say a comment. Every comment distances you from the person. So compliments you should give freely, and any comments have to be reserved for situations that it's really your job. You have to know what is within your capabilities. Unfortunately, as madrichim, people sometimes take on things that are beyond their capacity. A kid comes to you and tells you there's abuse going on in the house. You have to talk to someone else. You guys are not the ones to deal with it. if a girl tells you she's pregnant, you have to talk to other people. There are going to be issues that are beyond your capacity. You are not supposed to have all the answers. There's a story that Rav Shach, who was the chief rabbi of Bnei Brak, when he gave smicha to someone, so he sent him to be tested by all the lower rabbis. And then when he was finished being tested by them, he came to be tested by Rav Shach. So Rav Shach said, look, I trust all the other rabbis that tested you that you know your stuff. I have one more thing I need you to do before I can give you smicha rabbinic ordination. And he led him to a room and he said, I want you to sit in this room and say 500 times, I don't know. They tested you on what you do know. Once you get rabbinic ordination, when people will ask you a question, you'll feel the pressure of knowing the answer. So what you have to practice now, what I want you to know, is how to say, I don't know. So stay in this room, and when you finish practicing 500 times saying, I don't know, then I'm willing to give you rabbinic ordination. You guys are going out there to be madrichim, people are going to pose you with a lot of questions. Some of the questions you could consult with other people. Other questions, they're beyond your league. So don't try to tackle them. You also have to think long term. What we said earlier, if there's a problem of abuse in the home, you can't solve it long term. You need to get into the picture, you need to get people who can solve it long term. Maybe you'll be a part of the picture, but you need long term solutions. That's why there are organizations. That's why, I don't know what's in place in your countries, but there have to be organizations. If not, get the rabbis involved. And that brings us to another point. Let's skip forward to the next page. I have a list of points. So one of them is, the last two points is maintaining confidentiality. I don't know how it works within the ranks of Bnei Akiva, but I make a point. I make it very clear whenever I'm in a situation where people might be consulting with me and I'm part of an organization, whoever is my boss, I ask him in advance, tell me, do you expect me to tell you everything people tell me? Because if you do, I tell them point blank. If you do, I just have to let them know that. And then they won't tell me. So you have a choice. Either you tell me I have to tell you everything, fine. If I have to tell you everything, then I have to tell them that I'm telling you everything. The second they hear that, I've never had someone on top of me tell me everything. I've always heard them tell me, I leave it to your discretion. Sometimes, if you just ask them, should I tell you everything? They'll say, of course. But if you tell them, if you tell me that I have to tell them everything, I will tell them that, and then they won't tell me anything. So which do you want? Because either way, you won't hear. So the guy says, you're right, better you know. And you decide when you have to tell me. So that's one thing. On the other hand, there are times when it's your responsibility to tell. And here I have to tell you something which you might not believe me on. Usually people don't believe me on this point. I've said it to parents, and almost always they don't believe me, and they learn the hard way. And it hurts me to tell you this, but most people do not maintain confidentiality. I was once teaching in a school where one of the kids was evaluated by a psychologist. He had certain problems. The parents called me up and they tell me the kid was evaluated. So I tell them, let's keep it between me and you, because I don't think anything the psychologist said is relevant to the school. And if you tell the school, then I guarantee you it will spread through the school like wildfire. The child will be labeled. The school will not deal with him like a normal child, and it will harm the kid. So the parent didn't listen to me. And they went to the school counselor, or whoever it was in the school, I don't remember his exact position, and they said it to him. And I get to hear from the teachers that at the next staff meeting, in front of all the teachers, this counselor said, oh, you know so-and-so? He's got problems. He was by a psychologist. He was evaluated. Now all the teachers know. Now all the teachers are treating this kid like a problem kid because of what this guy said. So you'd think that people would behave responsibly. My experience has shown that people do not. And once you've let the words out of your mouth, you have to assume it's going to move forward and ultimately get back to the person who said it. Sometimes you have no choice. I've had instances where people told me things, they assumed I wouldn't tell them, and I had no choice for their safety or someone else's safety. A guy tells me, look, I'm on pills. I didn't tell it to the army, but I have psychological problems, but it's under control. And I lied on my form for the army, but I want to work things out with you. So what do you think I did? When he left the room, I called the army and I said, hey, you can't give this guy a gun. This guy is dangerous. The guy's not stable. It's very nice. He lied to you. You guys have to verify better, but don't give him a gun. So the guy finds out and he comes back to me. What'd you do? I did what I think was right. I'm sorry. You have to be ready to stand up when a person comes. I have nothing to apologize about. I feel bad.
You tell him that you would have told the army?
Oh, so I first worked the other route. I said, look, don't you think your responsibility is to tell the army? Don't you think you have to tell them? Do you want us to tell them together? Do you want us to work out a way to let the army know? First, I tried every route to get him to tell the army. When I didn't get there, so then I don't have a choice. On the other hand, I had a situation where a guy told me, how do I do tshuva for knocking out all of a person's teeth? That's the question. He comes to me one night, he says, I was walking down the street, and a guy was wearing a t-shirt that said such and such, and I said, you can't wear a t-shirt like that, and I pulled him into an alleyway and knocked him in the face so many times. When I was done, he had no teeth left. How do I do tshuva for that? And later on, I found out that there was some information about this guy that I should have halachically passed on to other authorities. The guy, certain halachic issues that I should have passed on. So I called up one of the rabbis I asked my questions to, and I said, look, I'm scared he's going to beat my teeth out. I don't want to say. Why should I risk my life? This is how violent this guy is. So it wasn't something that was endangering anyone else, it was a halachic issue. So the rabbi said, no, don't tell. In that instance, the halach is, you don't have to risk yourself to help someone else. So you should consult, and you also have to know when you have to maintain the confidentiality that they're entrusting in you, and when not. A guy tells you, look, I'm contemplating suicide. I was once a guy calls me up, says, I'm having a really bad day. I keep thinking about killing myself. But don't tell my wife. Okay, that's very nice. Am I being fair to him when I don't tell his wife? What do you think I did? I did my best talking to him. When I finished talking to him, I called his wife. What am I going to do? I'm going to have it on my head that he's telling me this. And the same thing with kids. The second a kid brings up something that's suicidal, you have to take it seriously. You can't play games with it. The pasuk says, we're going back to where we were on the page, nefesh seveah, when a person's full. You went to a good restaurant, you just had a great dessert, you're totally full. Tavus nofet. So then even when you bring them the sweetest thing, it says that I just can't. V'nefesh re'evah, but when you have someone who's hungry, when you're really, really hungry, kol mal matok, even the bitterest thing is sweet. Someone comes in with a glass of water. You've just been hiking. You're thirsty as anything. Oh, is that glass of water going to taste good? You come home and you're not so thirsty. So they say, is there juice? Something that, oh, you're only offering me water. Nothing better to drink? Depends on how thirsty we are. Chazal tells this pasuk wasn't talking specifically about food. The pasuk was telling us, in general, a question of attitude. When you're approaching the guys in Bnei Akiva, you have to develop, to tap into what are they hungering for. And that's why I began with what is every person hungering for? What are they thirsting for? The disruptive participant. So that's what you've been waiting for. But there's one point which I really think you guys have to think about. These are all keys for moving forward with content. What content are you giving them? The guys are going to ask you, what is Hanukkah all about? How much can you tell them? The guys are going to ask you, tell me, what's the difference between a biblical mitzvah and a rabbinic mitzvah? What are you going to say? The guys are going to ask you, why are you Orthodox? Why don't you get with the times and drive over to shul? What are you going to say? There are basic questions which you guys have to think about. You can't assume, well, I just got to get them connected. Where are you going to lead them from there? And they're going to sense, are you standing on steady footing or not? If you have answers, good. If you don't have answers, they're going to sense it. If you're giving them a watered down Torah, then they're saying, hey, this is watered down. Oh, yeah, okay. So you don't do everything, I don't do everything. Why do you think it's more important that I marry a Jewish woman? So what if I intermarry? Big deal. So my kids won't be Jews. What's being Jewish all about? Being connected, I'll send my kids to Bnei Akiva. That's what's so important. Buying Israeli bonds, I'll buy Israeli bonds. What's Judaism all about? I mean, we wrote that term up there, and I think we have to stop and think, wait a second, what are we telling them? They're going to ask you about Pesach. Yeah, so 2,000 years ago, our forefathers left Egypt. Very nice. Okay, so now we have Yom HaTzmaut. Why is that more important than anything else in this world? What's so special about the Exodus? Why on every Friday night do I have to commemorate that? The world was created in 6 days, and on the seventh God rested. So what? You don't think it's feasible that they're going to ask this? I would ask that. I asked this when I was a kid. And I'm older than you guys. My generation had more derech eretz. And this generation, you don't think they'll ask it? And what are you going to answer them? Why should I put on tefillin? Don't you feel pagan when you're standing there with a you have a branch, you're shaking around the branch? Come on, isn't that being a witch doctor? God really wants you to shake around the branch. That's what you do on Sukkot. You have to be primitive, go out and sit in a little hut. Don't you guys feel primitive? That's what Judaism is all about. What are you going to tell them? I'm asking questions, not giving you answers.
Can you give us a shiur in these answers?
It's not one shiur. It's a few shiurim. But I want you guys to think, wait a second, what are you telling them about? You're telling them about lighting candles. So they say, and what's wrong with the Hanukkah tree? What's wrong? Why does Hanukkah have to be celebrated with a bunch of oil lamps? Let's celebrate it with a Hanukkah tree. So you tell them a story about a nice lamp of oil that was found, and they'll say, yeah, okay, that was so many years ago. Let's do something more with the times. I'd much rather you give me gifts under my Hanukkah lamp or my Hanukkah tree. That means more to me. Okay, now I ask the questions. You give the answer. I'm asking you, what are you going to say when the guys ask you these questions? Why should I connect to Bnei Akiva? I came, now I'm a serious guy. I want to understand, why should I connect? You want me to come. What are you going to tell me? What am I connecting to? To what? To a social event? Guys and girls get together? Okay, I'll come. New Year's Eve, maybe I'll come. Instead of going to New Year's Eve party with my other friends, I'll come here. But what are you offering me? Okay. I'm listening. You choose the question. You want, I'll give you a new question. I'll give you your own question, but however you want. Torah tells me not to cut off my payas. God really cares if I cut these hairs? Is that really what interests God? God gives us a Torah, written law, right? God gives us 613 mitzvot. What are they all about? God has to tell me a mitzvah about how I cut my beard, that I shouldn't use a razor. God cares if I cut with a razor or not? What does God care if I cut with a razor? And does God care if I cheat on my taxes? Come on, everyone else. Oh, you'll tell me that's not a mitzvah. Fine. Either it is or it isn't. God tells me you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. What does God care what I think about when I'm lying in bed at home? I'm thinking my thoughts. I can't control my thoughts. The Torah tells me what to think. I'm asking you. You guys are the madrashim. 10 commandments. Very simple question. The guy's going to ask you, why is God telling me what to think? Can I control what I think? Come on. If a guy has a good looking neighbor, so maybe he'll think about her. Maybe he won't. God's telling me don't. God's telling me what to think.
Maybe coming from your thoughts, but it's your actions that count. Well, yeah,
it doesn't say you shall not.
It's not for God. God doesn't really care what you can say. God doesn't really care what you do. But it's for you, because everything you do here, it doesn't affect God, because like He doesn't need you. You need those things to make you a better person. Also, it'll help you if you just do that.
I'm a better person if I don't shave with a razor.
Maybe.
I'm a better person if I wear tzitzit. Well, God gave me the world to come because I wear tzitzit. He cares if I wear strings. He cares if I have four locks. What? That's a reminder, not shaving with a razor. That's a reminder. What? Tzitzit. Fine, I'm saying it. There are many mitzvot. If they're going to ask you about the most basic 10 commandments and you don't have answers, what are you offering them?
Fun.
fun. I think I don't see what they're going to come for. The question is, where are we going from here? Meaning, all of this is introductory. This is elementary to building a relationship, but that relationship has to have substance. So, what substance are we going to give them? I don't know. I don't see how it can be about fluff. The guys are the guys. If you want to give them something, you got to give them something real. Well, then you got to have something real to give them. I'm with you.
Can we control our thoughts?
Yes.
No.
He says no. I say yes. Right? I have a whole long class on that. On that commandment, thou shalt not covet. Right?
What he said as well, like, I don't know if you can. I don't know. I'm just wondering if you can control your thoughts. I don't know if you can control your
thoughts. For sure you can control your thoughts. It's one of the precepts of many mitzvot. And I could prove it to you. But that's... you want? I'll give you a simple proof. Do you sense your left toe right now?
No.
No. You do and you don't. Meaning, if someone put a knife in it, you'd sense it. It exists. But you're focused on hearing and talking. You're barely even noticing his tapping. Now, because I said it, you're focused on that. So we can focus our senses, and by the same token, we could focus our thoughts. Meaning, you could choose what you zone in on, even within your senses. Even though at any given moment, you feel your sleep. But right now, you're not thinking about your sleep. So you could decide where you focus your senses. By the same token, that's all focusing your mind. You could focus your mind on what you think about. You could choose to think about something or choose not. If the Torah says it is biblically prohibited for a person to willfully make himself hard, that means I have the ability to distract myself from a thought that begins in my mind. It's not that, well, whatever my mind decides, it thinks.
So you replace it with something else?
You can replace it. You could divert it. You could focus on something else. Sure, we control what we think about. That involves a longer class about thought and Judaism, but in general, guys, we're really way over time, and we've reached a juncture with the question that I want you guys to think about, because that should really be the foundation of everything we're saying. Is leading to what? The connection to which answers? If we don't have answers for the basic things, why should I honor my parents? So tell me, oh, it's nice, they took care of you, they brought you up. Okay, right, they did what their parents did for them, I do what my parents, I'll bring my kids to the world. I have to honor them? I have to fear them? God wants me to fear? Why do I have to fear them? Maybe the Torah never says love them. Why not love them? Shouldn't I love them? They did so much for me. That doesn't say in the Torah. But honor, fear, that it does say. Well, what's going on here? I don't understand this Torah thing. So now we're concluding with a question. And Bezrat Hashem, if you want, we'll have to figure out if we can find time to move forward. I hope I haven't offended anyone. Okay.